Okay, we live in two worlds, the world as we see it and the world as we'd like it to be. So, you think about this in terms of the environment. The world isn't the way it should be. Every year, and not just this year, you know, hundreds of square kilometres of the Amazon rainforest are burnt. About 20,000 square kilometres of the Amazonian rainforest are burnt every year. That's the same size as the area of Wales. You know, that's the world we live in, but we know it shouldn't be that way. We produce masses of plastic. You know, we know it takes centuries to decay, and all these tiny fragments are found everywhere. We don't quite know the effect on us. We sense this isn't the way the world should be, but that's what it is. You know, we look up and down Lye High Street and around where we live, you know, and there's litter, isn't there? Sometimes people dump huge bags and sofas and fridges and crazy things. You know, we know it shouldn't be this way, but that's what we've got. Every year we produce in Britain 222 million tonnes of rubbish every year. If you put it all together, you could cover the entire borough of Dudley in rubbish up to a depth of half a metre of horribleness. You know, this is the way the world is. We know it shouldn't be that way, should it? Most of the world's species of plants and animals are actually unidentified. There are so many of them. No one's ever really tracked down and said, what is this? There are 2.5 million species of insects. And yet at the same time, we live in an age in which many major species of animals are threatened with extinction. Now, we face a potential future where these kind of large signature animals like rhinos, tigers, lions, elephants, maybe, might no longer be found in the wild, but just exist in remnants in zoos. You know, we know this isn't the way the world should be, is it? If we look at our present world of suffering and imperfection, we see that's the environment, but because we live as Christians, actually there's hope in our hearts and minds. And we feel there is something better. We long for something better, and we know actually there is a glorious future. Maybe sometimes when we're walking with God, we feel stretched like an elastic band. There is a tension between the way things are, you know, and the way things should be. And that's what Paul is writing about here. If you look at verse 18 to 23, the bit I want to focus on, he says this. He writes about the present sufferings and the future glory. And the astonishing, surprising thing he says is that the transformation, the future glory of the entire created order, plants, animals, stars, rocks, trees, everything, in some way is related to our transformation. And I want to think this morning, as we think about the future of creation, first, that the best is yet to come for us, and secondly, the best is yet to come for all creation. So firstly, verse 18, the best is yet to come for us. Paul writes, as I said, our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Now, our present sufferings include many things. There's a whole range of human weaknesses. We suffer from accidents. We make mistakes. You know, we get ill. We grow weaker. We age. Ultimately, we die. But also, there's moral weakness as well. You know, we sin. We have an inbuilt tendency to break God's law, and yet we don't want to. We become proud. We don't always speak the truth. Sometimes we're jealous. Sometimes we're angry without a good reason. Sometimes we're lustful. Sometimes we're bitter. Sometimes we're hateful. All sorts of things. You know, we have thoughts and desires we don't want, we can't control. We feel enslaved by them. And all these things and more, they show the fact, you know, we know that's not the way we're meant to be. And whoever we are as human beings, inevitably, actually, we're going downhill. You can be rich, poor, brilliant, clever, supremely healthy, but for all of us, the grave, you rot and decay, is the end destination of 100% of humankind. However, we're here this morning in hope, aren't we? In Christ there is hope. If we belong to him, we have a relationship with God that will last forever. Earlier in this chapter, verse 11, Paul had written, "If the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead lives in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies." So we live with decay, but we live with hope as well at the same time. And what's this future state? It describes it as glory. And it's not simply glory revealed to us, it's glory revealed in us. Some way we're going to be changed. It's absolutely glorious. Now, one of the problems is our popular culture doesn't make out our future state in heaven to be a very exciting place. You know, it's full of people sitting around playing harps on clouds. You know, and the wonderful variety of God's creation is not there. You know, where are the plants, the birds, the animals? You know, it's fine if you like harp music. What I mean is that, you know, heaven is made out to be very otherworldly, misty, soppy. It's a bit insubstantial. You can't quite touch it. You know, there's definitely no football in heaven or fish and chips. It's a thing that you might stretch yourself to enjoy. But actually, you know, that's not what Paul says here. It's not what the Bible teaches. What does he say? "He who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies." You know, we experience eternal life as a whole. We're not just a spirit, we're body, soul and spirit when we're raised. And Jesus, God is not just going to, you're not going to live in heaven. We're going to live on a new heaven and a new earth. So the future is glorious. You know, and it's not denial of something. It's not something airy-fairy and over-spiritual. It's good and to be looked forward to. And this future state is glorious. The word glory in Hebrew is kabod. It means weight, heaviness, something that is really substantial. And think what it's saying in comparison with now. Now we have the shadows. Sometimes people some traditions talk about death as being kind of shadowlands, but actually this is the shadowlands compared to the real substance that is to come. Now, then we'll have perfection. Now we have imperfection. Then everything will last forever. Now everything is temporary. Then it means a complete reverse of all the problems we face now. They will vanish. They will be no more. So that's why Paul writes, our present sufferings, all the things we have now, the imperfections and the pain of now, our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. You know, the future glory is so great, the contrast between now and the future is so enormous, it's almost beyond words. There's a hint of what this might be like when we look at Jesus. So John, in his first letter, chapter 3, writes this. What we will be has not yet been made known, but we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him. When Jesus appears, you know, and we're transformed, we'll be like Jesus in some way. You'll be still recognised as who you are as a person, but there's a transformation that will be more like Jesus as well. And I think it means that, you know, the moral, spiritual side of us, the beauty of the character of Jesus will be seen inside us. So, you know, and that, you know, we struggle now for the fruit of the Spirit to grow in us, then it'll be there automatically, permanently, forever. That's a wonderful thought. And it means those things that Paul writes about in Galatians will be there. Forever. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. And the glory there is not just revealed to us. The surprising thing, it's revealed in us, because we will be changed inside. You know, what we are now and what the future will be like is like comparing, in some ways, a caterpillar to a butterfly. You know, the caterpillar bumbles along the ground, doesn't it? It's helpless, it's squashed, it's picked up by birds. It's lumpy, it's bumpy, it's slow. Often it's very ugly. It's easy to catch. But when it's transformed into a butterfly, you know, it's something glorious, it's elegant, it's colourful, it's free, it flutters, it's hard to catch, it's fast moving, it's its own master. You know, there's an enormous contrast there, isn't there? Between something, say, so earthly and something so glorious. But that's a contrast we can describe with words. You know, the contrast between what we are now and what we will be in the future will be even greater. It's incomparably greater. And that means that we become people of immense hope, immense joy. It means the most terrible and unfortunate things can happen to us or people we love. But we can say, because of Jesus, because he rose from the dead, the best is yet to come. I will not despair. There was a bishop who died recently, Gavin Reid, he was the Bishop of Maidstone. And he was talking to a teenager who'd spent something like 10 years in hospital through various illnesses, really had a really rough life. But this lad had become a Christian. And so the bishop asked him, "You've spent more than half your life in hospital. Don't you think God's been unfair to you?" Fair question. And many people would say yes. But the lad answered, "No. And anyway, he's got all eternity to make it up to me." That lad understood what had been written here, you know, profoundly. "I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us." So if that's what the transformation for us is going to be like, it gives a little picture of what the transformation for the entire creation is going to be like. Because that's what it's saying here in verses 18 to 23, that these two are linked. And actually, the transformation of our world and its fallen state depends on our transformation. So secondly, I want to talk about the best is yet to come for creation, there, verses 19 to 21. And by creation here, probably I think it means the entire cosmos. Universe, planets, you know, galaxies, everything, anywhere. Paul writes, "Creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed." And creation, of course, is not a person, it's impersonal. But it's not what it was meant to be, and it's waiting for something greater. And the word expectation here gives the impression of someone sort of standing on tiptoes and craning their neck forward and just so, you know, really trying to look over the fence, look over the crowd, because there's something they desperately want to see. Creation, you know, is not what it's meant to be. And the restoration of creation in the future depends on the revelation of God's children. Just think about the ways in which it needs to be restored. You know, the things that we do to it. There's pollution. We build over it. We dig it up. We chop it down. We hunt animals to extinction. We talked about that. But the problems of creation go deeper than that. Paul writes, "Creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of him who subjected it." It's a reference to the fall of Adam and Eve. But frustration there means something like futility, meaninglessness, purposelessness. You know, it's what we're referring to in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. You know, basically, creation is glorious, but actually, like our bodies, it's running downhill. And you see this on the big scale. The second law of thermodynamics states that in a closed system, disorder increases over time. What it means is that the universe, energy, matter become more and ultimately become more and more dispersed and disordered. For the moment, we have stars, planets, galaxies. But if you go forward billions and billions and billions of years, in the end, there's nothing. Everything is just, you know, sort of cosmic soup. It goes downhill. And yet, you look at stars in their beauty and their glory, their variety, their awesome size, the massive distances of the universe. You consider how finely balanced everything is mathematically. It says it's been designed. It's glorious, yet it's going downhill. As it says here, the universe is subject to frustration. It's glorious, but it's going nowhere. What's the purpose of it? It's meaningless. It's like it talks about in Ecclesiastes. Why? Why? It doesn't make sense. And then you look at life on this earth, and it's not as it's meant to be. Yes, it's beautiful. You know, and maybe all these nice nature programs look at the beauty of the world, but have you ever thought how cruel life is? The mortality rate amongst young mammals, reptiles, birds is horrendous. And think how animals live. Lions are serial killers. Dragonflies and wasps are no better. No, birds eat worms and snails while they're still alive. Often we look at nature and we just want to see it as nice. We see the bits we want to see. But in reality, it's one vast killing machine. The poet Tennyson wrote this about nature. It's red in tooth and claw. Look at plants. Every spring they come up, they're beautiful, there's new life. But since 6 months later, as we're just beginning now, there is death and decay on a massive scale when autumn comes. As it says in verse 21, it's in bondage to decay. What's the purpose of this? Life just goes round and round in circles, ever repeating itself and going nowhere. Suffering goes on and on and on. That's the sense of futility that's described in the book of Ecclesiastes. The wind blows to the south, it turns to the north, it goes round and round, ever returning on its course. Where is it going? In fact, the whole verse of the whole book of Ecclesiastes is a commentary on this verse. And that's even before we really begin to think about our effect on the planet. But why are things this way? Paul writes, creation was subjected to frustration not by its own choice, but by the will of him who subjected it. Creation was not made to be this way, but the fall of Adam and Eve had an effect on the whole created order, on everything God has made. Now, we don't quite know the mechanism by which that happened, but, you know, all creation is one, it's all God's creation. And so a major distortion in one bit at the head of it under Adam and Eve, and it spreads out and affects everything. The mechanism is a mystery, but it's like if you throw a stone into a pond, ripples spread out. Eve sinned, Adam followed, and the ripples from that sin spread out and affected the whole of creation. And so, you know, God made a good world full of good things for Adam and Eve to eat. But they disobeyed, and this relationship with the earth was broken. And so the earth, instead of being a place that provides food in abundance, now doesn't. So God says to Adam, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat from it. By the sweat of your brow you will eat food." So, you know, one of the purposes of the earth to provide food is frustrated. It's disrupted by the fall. You know, so work becomes a battle, drudgery, slavery. But that's not the end of the story, verse 21. You see, what we're looking to is that one day creation will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Just as it's hard to imagine what our future resurrection bodies will be like, likewise, it's hard to imagine what this future world will be like. You know, today we look at nature. We can see much that's great, that's beautiful. But actually, however good it might be, it is flawed. It's not what it's meant to be because of the fall. You know, but then multiply the goodness we see now 1,000 times and do it again and again. You know, we haven't even begun to comprehend how great and glorious the new heavens and the new earth will be. So the long-term future of our planet is actually tied up with our future, it says here. It'll be brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. The one transformation of the earth depends in some way on our transformation. The world, we will be renewed when we're all renewed. And so if we want a better environment, ultimately, part of that is we need better people. So where does that leave us? The story of the whole Bible is Jesus. The story of the whole Bible is the gospel, God coming to save us. How does this, what we're talking about here, relate to the gospel? Firstly, our environmental problems show that we cannot save ourselves. Now, it's interesting, you read secular books about our environmental problem, and actually, where they are thorough, they also have a sense of despair, because they know the problem is so big, it cannot be sorted out by ourselves. This is a comment from a man called Stephen Emmott, writing about world population. His book is called 10 Billion, and he says this towards the end of his book. Only an idiot can deny there is a limit to how many people our Earth can support. The question is it 7 billion, our current population, 10 billion, or 28 billion? I think we've gone past it, well past it. We could change our situation we are now in, probably not by technologizing our way out of it, but by radically changing our behavior. In other words, he's saying we need new people. And then he says, but there is no sign of that this is happening or about to happen. You know? That's a secular person recognizing the spiritual state we're in, subject to frustration, fallen. We cannot save ourselves. One of the problems today is that we're materialists. For most people, this world is all there is. And if you want to be happy in life, you accumulate things. You accumulate material stuff. And sometimes that may not actually be physical things. It might be experiences, travel. For many people, these material goods are their gods. But if you believe this life is all there is, it's very difficult to get rid of those gods, to throw those idols down. The environmental problem in the end is a spiritual problem. And we don't want to realise this. This is what American writer Upton Sinclair wrote. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. That's where we are. You see, we don't want to understand the truth because it affects the idols we worship. If we want to be live in a changed world, we need God to change our hearts. And if we worship stuff, in the end, it will destroy us. That's the same with all idolatry. But the good news is this, that God has not left us this way. God stepped down into our environmentally broken world and even became part of it. The Son of God was born as a man with a human body in a fallen world. And because of wickedness and selfishness of this broken world, he was murdered. But he was more powerful than all the sin that and the evil that was thrown on him. So he rose from the dead. Going back to chapter 8, verse 11 here. If the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead lives in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies because of his spirit who lives in you. Our resurrection depends on being in Christ, and we will be raised. And Jesus doesn't, just redeem our bodies. He's planned something far greater. That's the restoration of everything that exists everywhere. And if you look in Colossians chapter 1, you have a sense of this big vision. There it says, Jesus will reconcile not people, but all things. He will reconcile all things, whether on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. You see, the good news, the gospel is good news for the environment. If people come into a right relationship with God, it will change their attitude to the world around them. The gospel is good news for the environment because ultimately it means God will restore everything. So what does it mean for us in terms of our stewardship of the planet? How do we care for the environment? First, it says there's a sense of realism you know, what we're not called to do. We cannot save the planet, as people sometimes talk about. You know, we need a certain sense of humility. The total transformation of everything is God's work. You know, then we need to care for creation. That was the first commandment we were given. Adam was told to subdue the earth. He was given a garden to care for. The earth was entrusted to us. And by God, we're to look after it. If we're serious Christians, disciples, we need to care for the environment. You know, and we cannot go on living the way we do. We consume too much. If everyone on this planet lived with the same standard of living that we have in Britain, we would need a world two and a half times bigger to meet its need. You know, we cannot keep living the way we do. But we do care for the environment because it's a sign of what is to come. All the small things we do now to make a difference are actually signposts pointing towards what God is going to do one day on a massive scale. Now, what we do now in caring for the environment by recycling, reusing, by using less, all these things, it's like a young child writing a placard. And on that placard, he's written, and it's only September, Wolves FA Cup winners. And it seems ridiculous. You know, and his mother says, Dad says, you've not even got to the third round yet. Why are you waiting this? Why are you writing this? But the child says, I know they'll win. I know they'll win. It's a sign pointing to the future. Of course, believing that Wolves are going to win the FA Cup is slightly hopeless, probably. And the bad news is they probably won't. They might do. I may be proved wrong. You may be laughing at me in 7 months' time. But, you know, we know, the difference for us is that we know God will totally restore the earth because Jesus has risen from the dead. And if you can raise Jesus from the dead with all the weight of sin on him, the restoration of creation is nothing. And our creation is like that placard. Our care of the environment is like that placard, a sign of what is to come. Let's pray.